Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive, but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey everybody, Pascal here. Time for another episode of Disrupt Disruption. I am here with Natasha Getch, goes by Tash, so we'll refer to you as Tash. I'm extremely excited about this conversation because it will be a very different conversation. Tash has a Master's of Science in Global Crime, Justice and Security from the University of Edinburgh. She works today as the Chief Operating Officer at Signal. Before that, she spent 9 years working with the UK Ministry of Defence, specializing in intelligence. Her final role in defence, and this is where I met Tash, was as Chief Operating Officer of the MOD's most successful innovation team, responsible for delivering novel technology in machine learning, data science, special operations, and sustainability to defence through user-centered design and non-traditional suppliers. That is a mouthful. It's also super interesting. Tash, I'm really excited to have you on this podcast. Welcome.
Thanks, Pascal. I've been really looking forward to it.
So I'm curious, as someone who's bridging the world of private and public sector and have been doing this very successful for quite a while, what is your mental model to think about innovation and disruption? Where do you start when you embark on a journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So sort of came to innovation accidentally, actually. I was working in intelligence. I loved my job in intelligence. When you're in your early 20s and you get to work on all sorts of very interesting things, it's a great career and no one would sniff at that. But I had been frustrated the entire time that I was there at the rate and pace at which any large organization can adopt a new technology. And the sort of the agile and nimble nature of the way that startups work and the way that things like software development work were just so outside of what the government was able to keep up with that I came to innovation because it seemed like a route out of that problem. It seemed like a really good way for me as a user to be able to work with the rest of my community, to be able to advise, to provide subject matter expertise in some really niche areas. And when that opportunity was presented to me, I just jumped at it and I didn't think very actively about what it is that I was getting into then. I just wanted to fix the immediate problem that I had. So in answer to your question about sort of bridging that gap between really large organizations and startups and sort of very cutting edge technology, in actual fact, the sort of, for me, the central linchpin is the user and the actual requirement and the job to be done. So I think if you can oscillate around those things, actually you can find the connective tissue that brings any sort of organization together.
You talked a little bit about your frustration or your challenges you found in innovation and disruption processes. We like to talk a lot about the four horse person, the idea is like at least four things we see over and over and over again. I'm curious, what have you found is that the typical faults organizations fall into, as in what makes them stumble over their own 2 feet? And maybe also curious to hear if you find there's a difference in the public versus the private sector.
Great question. So this might be too simple, but this is the way that I think about it. Organizations, whether or not they are super large sort of mega corporates or government departments or startups, they're all occupied by people. Like, we are humans at a sort of a fundamental level. And as humans, we'll go through our education process, we'll become socialized, we understand certain constraints and mental models, and then we decide what things are important to us. And for some people, that's safety and security. For some people, that's the status quo. And for other people, it's how much can I achieve and how ambitious can I be? And what I have found is that you will find a mix of that spectrum of people in any organization. So when it comes to innovating in any set of environment, for me, it's much more about the individual level. Who can you connect with? Who wants to engage on innovation? Who wants to engage on capability development in a governmental sense? And how can you take them with you on a journey? And also, how can you be really responsive and sort of interested and genuinely listening to the concerns of those people who are resisting? Because in any organization, there will be people who are resisting one strategic decision or another, or they think that your government department doesn't need this piece of technology, or that your startup doesn't want to go in this direction. And more often than not, the objections that they are giving you up front don't really sit at the root cause of what it is that's bothering them. So how do you work in as empathetic a way as possible to connect with those people, to understand the deep-rooted set of drivers that are causing their response to you in that innovation environment? And it doesn't always work, and I'm certainly no sort of magician at it, but if you can try and connect with people on that level, you can at least engage on the debate about the idea or the process or the innovation you're looking to take forward. And if you still can't win them round, then you still can't win them round. Like, nobody wins all the time. But you will walk away, I think, from that conversation a lot less frustrated. It was one of the actually most interesting kind of reflections I had on my time in government. You would come across people who were very resistant to the idea of what we were doing at the J-Hub. It was an open innovation platform. It was seeking out dual-use technologies. It was looking to work with startups and founders. And all of those things are considered hugely high risk to a government department. It doesn't feel, when you're dealing with something as important as what the Ministry of Defence does, it feels silly to go and work with a founder who's got a team of three people. And it feels much safer to stick to what the organisation knows. And working with them to understand that actually what sits underneath that quite often are some quite primal fears about security and safety, and how will I ensure that my team, my role is successful and I'm able to deliver the things that I need to. Understanding it on that level has been the most effective way I've found of making progress.
In this context, and you've worked in government with huge governmental organization, Ministry of Defense, how do you scale this up? It sounds really hard to scale. If you want to be empathetic to your users, you can do this for 1, 2, 3 people, but how do you scale it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would think of that organization as kind of coming in stages. I'm a strong believer in the power of showing somebody something rather than telling them. Mm-hmm. So when it came to the sort of very early days of that organization, we operated largely in stealth for the first 18 months and reached out to some user sets. You know, I actually came on board as a user. So someone reached out to me and said, well, you work in intelligence, you work in this specific area. We would like to help fix your problems. Come to a meeting. So we operated largely in stealth and brought on those users and worked with them to try and fix their problems in really small use cases. For an organization like the Ministry of Defense, a £20,000 or a £50,000 project or contract is nothing. Like, that's a rounding error on many of these spreadsheets. But the power of that, to be able to show people what can be done, to be able to place that contract in a matter of months rather than years, to be able to deliver on someone's desk a piece of software that enables them to do the thing that they have not been able to do for the last sort of, you know, 15 years effectively, that's hugely powerful. And you get those early adopters, but they're more like evangelists. They will be very excited about this process and they will say, okay, well, you know, you might think it's silly, but it worked for me. Once we had those proof points, it started to become a lot simpler. And then there were different complexities around, okay, well, how do we clearly articulate what the role of the organization is? Like, we are not a blank checkbook for anybody who can't get anything funded in any other direction to come to us and to this organization will sort it for me. How do we really establish ourselves as a organization that wants to pursue some really challenging tech in that environment? And I mean that in the sense of going after something that's dual use, being a bit creative about the way that we employ technology and thinking really laterally about some novel solutions. And that stage of the development was really interesting because there were two challenges. There were some people who were trying to pull us back into a sort of a very easy procurement house type role. And then there were some people who wanted us to pull forward and for everybody to suddenly have an innovation mindset in defense and to have that overnight. And as I'm sure you'll know better than I, it doesn't happen like that. So there's a gradual process involved, absolutely. And I think by the time I left that organization, it really had moved on to the sort of third iteration, whereby it was acknowledged by everyone in the team that if the only place that anybody innovated within the Ministry of Defence was within the J-Hub or any of the other innovation hubs or centres, and there, you know, there are now a bunch of them and they're all doing amazing things in their respective areas, if that was the only place that innovation happened, one, that would be a crying shame. Right. Two, it's not going to move the needle, and we need to move the needle. So the final iteration just as I left was okay, how do we make this sort of open innovation concept really more of a mindset? Like, how do we make it really more of a theme that people can employ as and when they want to? How do we sort of package this for the mass market? And it's not going to look as fun as it did when we were running around writing checks for £25,000-£50,000 to be able to get software onto people's computers, but it may be much more meaningful in the long term.
So you talked about the £20,000 pilot, and it sounds to me like you actually, as in your organization, you had the funding to basically provide that instead of relying on your counterparts in other parts of the defense department to provide this. Mm-hmm. I think that's clever, because a lot of times I hear people telling me it's easier for me to get $2 million than it is for me to get $20,000, right? Because the paperwork assigned to it is the same. But how do you get to buy in? If you pay for it, how do you get the other person to actually buy in and not just like, oh yeah, it's fine. You know, like, you paid for it. It's your thing. It's a nice check mark. Innovation theater.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's very difficult to value what you don't pay for. So we would work with user sets, and typically actually we'd find really junior people within the organization. So the Ministry of Defense obviously has got an enormous number of hierarchies, both in the civil service side of the organization and in the military side of the organization. And that is for very good reason. When you are in the midst of war, you need to know who's in charge and who you're reporting to. But what it means is you end up with these many, many layers of distinction between those people who are doing the job. And by that, if in my experience, that was collecting intelligence and analyzing it and writing reports, and the people all the way up at the top who are making big strategic decisions about what to do about it. We engaged at the start with the people right at the very bottom. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, they really understand the job to be done. So if we want to very robustly defend why we're doing this and what the purpose is, there's no one better to ask than the person who gets shouted at for not doing it to the best of the ability of whatever the world has to offer. So that person is inherently quite engaged. We also asked their sort of immediate boss to commit some of their time. And that, again, it's basic behavioral science concepts. Like, let's get some commitments out of people in public, and that says that they're much more likely to do it. So when we would engage with that user and we'd help them to scope whichever technology it was, and we'd help them to look at different providers and startups and founders, and we'd run a competition to see who was the best option there, and we would do, and it's really important to state that we didn't actually circumvent any single one of the processes. I mean, it's still taxpayers' money, absolutely, and there is a responsibility that comes with that. But when it's much smaller amounts of money, there is still scrutiny, but it's less scrutiny that's applied to that. And we were very lucky to have a multidisciplinary team that would enable us to write contracts in line with all of the regulations we had to follow. The other, like the second interesting bit about engaging that really junior user is, even just psychologically, to somebody who's really junior in their early 20s, this is their first or second job, £20,000 is a lot of money. Like, they think of it as a lot of money. And when you're a very senior general and 30 years in, £20,000 doesn't feel like anything at all. So you actually end up getting, they take it really seriously, because that's the kind of money they don't have. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So yeah, we had our own sort of small budget to be able to play with first. And that was hugely instrumental in enabling us to move forward. And when what you need to do is to create those proof points, having even just a seed amount of money makes a big difference. But we would have to, the way that our process worked is we would sort of quarterly, we'd compile all these projects we've been working on, and we'd take all of the data from the KPIs, and we would take all of the feedback from other departments, and, you know, do the really exciting stuff, like think about how we're going to integrate this IT system with that IT system and that sort of thing. We put these all together in big project packs and pitches, and then we would take it to essentially what was an investment committee. It was the innovation committee within the organization. And we'd pitch for the funding to continue that project for 1 or 2 years or whatever it was. And it used to make me chuckle that we would sit at this investment committee equivalent, and it would be myself and a couple of the others from the J-Hub and the users who were involved in pitching the project. And on the other side of the table, there would be around 20 stars, like a 4-star general, 2 3-star generals, you know, 6 2-stars, everybody else. And we would be asking for amounts of money. The time it took us to go through that process and have them question it on us, we'd probably spend more money having these people in the room during the course of this conversation. feedback. The four-star head of the organization acknowledged this, but understood how psychologically it was so important to have that direct engagement. It was so important to be seen to be engaging with this new process and this new technology. And we were just hugely fortunate that every single commander we had while I was there was massively engaged and supportive.
How did you in this context deal with failure? Because presumably not every single one of your projects worked out.
Yeah.
Even worse, you're spending taxpayers' money.
Yep.
So it's not like some private investor or VC fund who lost their money and so what? It's their business. How did you overcome this, like the challenges which come with failing and failing being such an instrumental part of any innovation initiative?
Yeah, absolutely. So interestingly, because we had so many different sort of check boxes to still get through before we could get to that investment committee stage, mm-hmm. when projects would fail, they would fail much earlier in the process. But I have to say, still heartbreaking for the people who are involved. You know, you've been in a engineering job, or you've been in a cyber job, or you've been in a medical job for 10, 15, 20 years, and you've desperately wanted this piece of kit. You've saved lives in Afghanistan. You know how important this is, how what difference this could make to the people that you work with and care about. And to be told by somebody who works in an innovation hub, great idea, can see where you're going, but you know it doesn't work out on a cost-benefit analysis, and that is heartbreaking. And it's one of the things that I always loved about defense and still love about defense is it has enormous value. And it's the people that really make that organization. So those failures felt like personally letting them down, even if you have to make pragmatic business decisions, because exactly as you say, it's still taxpayers' money. In terms of mitigating the risk to the taxpayers' money, we would always, you know, follow concepts like MVP, and we would always push for the smallest, lightest, most agile trial we could possibly get away with, and then build upon that once we had some confidence metrics in there. And we would look to end these things as quickly as possible if they weren't going the way that we were supposed to. We were happy to engage in some co-development. It was a great example where we had an almost perfect product fit for something that we were testing on operations. And everyone was super excited about this project. And we had tested it in an office environment, and we tested it in a factory. And then as soon as we got it out to operations, we realized that in the quiet, it was about 50 times louder than it needed to be. And it's very difficult to take a piece of tactical kit right to the front line if it's a screaming beacon of where you are. So those sorts of things, like we learned a huge amount, but that trial only cost us a couple of £1,000 because right. all the kit and equipment was going anyway.
At the J-Hub, you did mostly external innovation. So you brought in innovation, if I understand this correctly, right? So you brought innovation from the startup community, maybe other vendors, maybe user-generated innovation. I'm curious, how do you think about the balance between internal innovation and internal development, product development, et cetera, versus the benefit you get from external innovation? How do you keep the balance, if there is a balance?
Yeah, so I think the two complement each other really well. There's a challenge in any organization where people have got day jobs, and where are they going to find the time to start tinkering away? And actually, the Ministry of Defence is a great environment for doing that. We've got lots of workshops and hangars, we've got lots of engineering departments and tools and equipment. It's a great environment to start doing that. And the Ministry of Defence actually has a really strong and proud history of innovating on operations. There's one thing you can say about the British military is if they're in a bind, they will find a creative solution to fixing that problem. So that innovation mindset is there and it has been used to huge effect. But it's very challenging to do that on a day-to-day running when you're not in a conflict situation where you don't have that kind of pressure. So what the J-Hub wanted to do was try and create the space to do that. But you can't just bring people into a shared office space and go, right, innovate. But you can introduce them to some really cool people, and you can show them what is possible with some really cool tech. And that is a brilliant process. The challenge we had was working with them on ideating. So that's not a process that sort of taught in a sense that you and I would think about it. And the default is like square peg, square hole. Quite often we'd have somebody come to us and go, right, we need VR. Okay, that was the answer to the question. What was the question? But yeah, so we need to do this thing and we need VR for it. So can you help us get some VR? Yeah, you still haven't explained to me what it is that you're actually trying to do.
Yeah.
Let's go back a few steps, look at the problem. think about, VR may well be the solution, but let's think about a number of different ways that we could address this. And then let's think about whether or not we need to bring in somebody external, either to work alongside you to develop it, or actually you can work alongside them to repurpose a product that they already have.
In that experience, how do you find the success rate differed between the approach where you really start with a question, as in like, we've got the following problem, blue ocean, we figure out, we look at all the possible solutions, versus someone coming with a kind of a pre-made solution, as in, here's a problem, I know this kind of thing works, now we need to like figure out how to scale it, if, you know, etc. How do you see the approaches working? Or which one is better?
I think my preference was the former, and that is because in the latter, where people would come with this really strong belief about what it is that they needed to solve the problem that they had, it was very difficult to get them off that idea. It's very difficult to get them to look at something else. Particularly because in the organization, maybe your boss agrees that VR is the solution and you've been dreaming about this VR now for 6 weeks and now you're really excited about it. To get someone off of that idea and to get them focused on something else was really challenging. I used to love the sort of blue ocean, I've got this problem, don't know if it can be fixed, but it'd be really great if you can help us type solution. We used to have a process whereby we'd sort of package these up and there was a huge amount of translation required between a military context and startup world and founders. We'd have to package up these ideas in a human digestible form and be able to take them out. You know, we'd work with VCs and we'd work with accelerators who were so well connected to all these fantastic startups and founders. And sometimes, this is just the sort of the biases that you have, sometimes you think you've packaged this idea up so that it's really straightforward and simple and how could nobody understand this? And you go to a room full of super talented engineers and you go, this is my problem. And they go, we have no idea what you're talking about. Like, can you draw it? But just going with an idea and going with no preconception of what you think the solution might be, I have been astounded at sometimes the responses that a technologist will come back at you with, because you never would have thought of that. And that process itself is beautiful.
You were really early in J-Hub and yeah. This organization grew quite a bit. I'm curious, any kind of gotchas you had in terms of starting something like this? Because I think it translates beautifully, or should translate beautifully, into lessons learned for large corporations who want to start or have an innovation lab and like it might not go quite as well as they want it to go.
Mm-hmm. This is sort of fitting for the nature of this podcast. The biggest lesson I learned maybe after the first 18 months, 2 years, that took us a while to regain from, to be honest, it was a bit of a slap in the face. You know that slap in the face moment you have every time you start something and then you think you're really clever and eventually you realize that you're not? And it was about the nature and conduct of disruption. So you can think that you know more than everybody else, you're cooler than everybody else, you're allowed to wear jeans and trainers, everybody else has to wear uniform, and you spend all this time with VCs and startups. So of course you know better. And anybody that you're talking to that doesn't agree that the concept that you've just come up with is the best thing ever, and that accessing dual-use technology and user-centered design and working with startups is the best idea ever, is an idiot, and they'll see. I certainly think that because we had some really good early successes, we got overexcited. And the ego piece runs away with you and you think, well, this works in this area and this area, so it's going to work in every area and people just need to see that as quickly as they possibly can. And coming back to my earlier point, this entire planet is just, our experience of it is dominated by humans and human emotion and their responses to change and disruption. And the whole kind of bull in a china shop approach to disruption is just so damaging, and it takes a long time to rebuild trust and rebuild your reputation and get people to engage with you after that. You absolutely cannot set fire to the table and then complain that you've got nowhere to eat. That you have to be gentle with people and work with them in order to bring them on board.
That's so interesting. It goes back to a story we had on this podcast from a gentleman called Maurice Conti, who used to run Telefonica Alpha's Moonshot Factory. And he talked a lot about like the necessity to actually commit to the outcome of the effort, the innovation and disruption effort, and not just to the process itself, because it sounds cool. He likes to talk about, or he likens it to owning the pet tiger, which sounds like an amazing, cool idea until you have one and you realize it's an utter pain. How do you get people to actually own to the outcome?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. And I wonder if, because the J-Hub was focused on delivering tech, but also in trying to, as I say, shift the needle in defense and to change your mindset around kind of technology adoption. And because we had two outcomes there, and those outcomes are very challenging to manage simultaneously, getting people on an individual project level focused on the outcome was relatively easy because you'd have a team of engineers who wanted this engineering solution, and if you gave it to them, they were very happy and off they popped. But how do we get the seniors involved? How do we get the organization writ large? How do we get entire teams for whom this sort of concept of open innovation is the worst thing that's ever happened to them? And I mean that in the sense that it just turns the table over on what has been working for decades, if not centuries, and it creates a whole lot of extra work. And it's a real pain, like it's that tiger. You think it'd be really cool to have an open innovation hub, and then you realize that it's eaten everything in your house. And getting people to come along with that idea is really challenging. And I know it's a challenge that is sort of ongoing, and I think it always will be, because people change, posts turn over, roles move. In terms of being what we were focused on, actually, I'd almost look at it the other way at the J-Hub. I would say that us delivering a £50,000 project that puts one piece of software on one team's computer is great for them, but it doesn't meet our eventual outcomes. We were certainly more about showing people the art of the possible, showing them that they can steer their own, you know, user requirements, showing them that there are other ways to go about sort of fixing these problems. I think that was our outcome, and it was certainly very difficult to measure, and it is a moving target. But it was one that we were really focused on trying to inspire an idea rather than necessarily the delivery of individual projects. That may be because we're not a corporation, and we're not sort of focused in that way on generating profit or coming up with new products in that sense. That might be a discrepancy between the two types of organization.
Looking back at your time at the J-Hub and I guess your career, what are a couple of things, or one thing at least, which you know now, which you wish you would have known earlier?
Great question. Okay, so two things, and I'll make them quick, I promise. The first one is really all about, you have to be very careful about how you treat people. You have to treat everybody with, you know, the utmost level of respect and care, because you're trying to get them to come on a journey with you. But also, if you upset that person, they will remember you, and it will make life harder for you further on down the line. And the second one is, I've been lucky enough to work with some spectacular subject matter experts, deep technologists, and across all sorts of fields. I've been really, really lucky. I think one of the most interesting things is that, you know, we are all sort of fallible in our own funny kind of way, and we're all trying to do the right thing and in the best way, and we're all positively engaged in making defense or the environment or the world a better place. But everybody's fallible, everybody has failings, and you have to lean on people around you, and you have to make sure that your decision making is as collective and as informed as it possibly can be, because like ego is just the worst thing for progress in a meaningful sense.
Tash, on those wise words, I love that you brought up ego. As a quick sneak preview, I think I'm going to write my next book about the essence of what we've learned from every single innovation and disruption process and failure. I think when you bring it down to the absolute essence, it only is two factors, fear and ego.
Yeah.
So on that comment, Tash, this was a super fascinating conversation. I could have continued this for hours. Thank you so, so, so much. Love the insights you brought. I love this interesting perspective on innovation and disruption from a perspective of the public sector. We had people from NASA here before, but really talking it also from the defense sector, where it's really about saving lives and the nation's security, which I think sets the stakes in a very different way. Mm-hmm. And it's really refreshing to hearing that in these environments, we still use largely the same innovation and disruption processes, the same approaches. It's about being empathetic, and it's about getting people really interested and motivated to drive the change and then empowering them to do so. Absolutely love the insights. Tash, thank you so much for being on this podcast. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. Speak soon.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and leave a quick review. It helps tremendously with getting the insights from our guests out into the world. If you have any questions, send me an email. You can reach me at pascal@finet.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.